I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. It's good to see some green, and I hope everybody here had a chance to get their Shamrock Shake on Shamrock Shake Day. Before we get to our agenda, I'll just go through the safety statement here. Everyone here today must be seated when they are in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifier's table. Please leave all signs outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. All of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to these limits or you may be cut off. The time limits are provided so we can keep the meeting on track. Thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present for helping maintain decorum. Members, there are five bills on the agenda, and thank you to everyone who submitted letters and written testimony. Committee materials are posted online, and there are limited copies for the public at the front entrance. Before we start with the bills, first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Curran may have a motion to approve the minutes for March 11, 2026.
So moved, Chair.
Representative Curran moves approval of the minutes for March 11, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 11, 2026 are approved. The first bill on the calendar today is House File 3771. It's a Representative Johnson bill. And Representative Johnson, would you like to move that House File 3771 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Chair Mueller, that is my motion.
All right, your bill is before us. I don't see that you have any amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair. House File 3771 is just a really simple change to a date that the Commissioner of Management and Budget must support a report detailing state disaster assistance appropriation and expenditures to the legislature, and that date would change from January 15th to January 31st. Currently, with that 15-day limit, it just is a very tight timeline to work across both management and budget and the Department of Public Safety to get all the appropriate information and data. And this increase still allows the legislature to get that report should we need to act on it for any particular reason.
All right. Thank you. We did not have anyone sign up to testify. I understand someone from MMB is here if there are questions that we need them to answer. Do we have any questions or comments about the bill? All right. Any closing remarks?
Nope. Yes, vote would be appreciated. Thank you.
All right. Quit while you're ahead. all right. Representative Johnson reduced the motion to recommend. All right. Representative Johnson reduced the motion to recommend that House File 3771 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, the next bill up is House File 3658. It's Chair Frazier's bill. And since you're not a member of the committee, I will move to re-refer House File 3658 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And I see that you do have an A1 amendment. And so I will also move the A1 amendment. Would you like to explain the amendment now or as part of your bill?
I'll explain it now.
Go ahead.
I've incorporated. This amendment allows for, right now, process to serve these have to be in person. This amendment would allow for service to be allowed by electronic service, also by via email.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. All right. Your bill, as amended, is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, co-chair. Thank you for the time to be here. It always feels pretty good to come back to this committee. Spent a lot of time here in my first couple terms. A lot of good, robust debate, always very important for the safety of our state here. So I appreciate being here when I have the opportunity. House File 3658 is about building on something that is already working and making sure it works even better for the people we serve. Since Minnesota's Extreme Risk Protection Order law went into effect, it has proven to be exactly what we intended it to be, a targeted, evidence-based tool to intervene in moments of crisis and prevent harm before it happens. Since the effective date, courts have issued orders restricting firearm access for more than 280 individuals and counting who were found to pose a significant risk. And when you look closer to those cases, you see exactly why these tools matter. We're talking about credible threats to schools and daycares. We're talking about individuals discussing workplace violence or confrontations with law enforcement. And in nearly half of these cases, there were direct threats against other people. Those are the moments where intervention matters most and where this law is doing its job. What's also clear is that this process is being used responsibly. The majority of petitions are brought forward by law enforcement, and courts are carefully reviewing the evidence, granting orders when a legal standard is met, and denying them when a legal standard is not met. That's what due process looks like in practice. So as we bring forward these updates, I want to be clear. This is not about changing the foundation of the law. It's about making it work better. One of the most important updates is expanding who can step in during a crisis. This bill broadens eligibility by aligning the definition of family or household member with Minnesota's existing order for protection process, so that blood relatives and former cohabitants can petition when they see warning signs, because often the people closest to a crisis are the first to recognize it. And importantly, this bill also allows individuals in crisis to petition on their own behalf, creating a pathway for someone to take responsible action before a situation escalates. We also address real operational challenges. We require judges to consider petitions for emergency relief when they are filed. This ensures that when a crisis arises, whether it's after hours or on a weekend, those petitions are acted on in a timely way, because in these moments, time matters. We remove the requirement that law enforcement agencies compensate respondents at fair market value when firearms are permanently transferred. That provision has created real barriers for agencies. These changes remove the burden while still preserving a clear path for respondents to transfer or sell firearms through licensed dealers. We also make a practical improvement by allowing orders issued after a hearing to be served electronically or by first-class mail, rather than requiring personal service in every case. That reduces strain on law enforcement and avoids unnecessary repeat contact. And more broadly, by ensuring mental health professionals can report credible threats to the appropriate local law enforcement agency, we are strengthening coordination and response at critical moments. Members, these are practical, informed updates, grounded in real experience. We make it easier for the right people to act, we make the system more consistent, and we remove barriers that limit effectiveness. And at the end of the day, this is about prevention. It's about recognizing warning signs and acting before tragedy occurs. And the data shows that exactly what this law is helping us to do. These modifications simply make a strong law stronger and ensure it continues to protect Minnesota communities in the way it was designed to. And I will note for members in the packet, there's support letters from the Chiefs Association, who has been a great partner in this from day one into exception and continue to be a great partner, and from Violence Free Minnesota, also looking out for survivors in our community, and they continue to be great partners as well.
All right, thank you. And did you want Mr. Diebel to walk through the bill too? Is that?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. If Mr. Diebel can walk through the bill, that would be great. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, I'll walk through the bill. Representative Frazier touched on most of the provisions that were amended, so I'll move quickly through here. On page 1 of 3658 is the petition, is the action to change the definition for who is eligible to petition, and changing that to the correlate with the 518B.01 definition of family or household members. On page 2, there is an amendment at the top on page 2.5 where currently drafted, it refers to just the county attorney, and this would allow for the county attorney's agency to apply for a petition, not just the elected official. And the same applies for the city attorney's office. It doesn't need to be the city attorney. Moving to page 3 of the bill, there's a update here that informs law enforcement that if there are exigent circumstances, the fact that there's an ERPO petition pending does not prohibit them from taking action on an emergency situation with the respondent. And then on 3.23 of that page 3 is where the requirement that a judge, when they receive an ERPO petition from law enforcement, they are expected to review the petition as regardless of the time of day or the date that it comes in. At the bottom of page 3 on 3.30, that is the provision where Representative Frazier mentioned that mental health professionals who have a duty to warn would be expected to provide a warning to the chief law enforcement officer in or the law enforcement agency in the area that the provider's patient resides. Moving to page 4 of the bill, this seeks to clarify which law enforcement agency is responsible for serving IRPOs and also is where the changes are made to when personal service is required as opposed to mail or electronic service. The amendment addresses the language on page 5. It deletes the new language and replaces it with the A1 amendment. And again, that's all related to the issue of establishing clear guidelines for practitioners and law enforcement as to when personal service is required as opposed to electronic or mail service is adequate. On page 6 of the bill, the initial changes amend the provisions which provide guidance to petitioners as to the information they're expected to provide the court to make their decision. So this adds some clarifying language and expands in some of the provisions so that more information is provided to the court for them, the judge, to make the decision on the petition. Moving down at the bottom of the page, this provides for a respondent to agree to a longer IRPO order than 1 year if they agree to the have it extend beyond the original year period. Moving to page 7 at the top of the page, there's some conforming language. This clears up some, I'd call that technical. And then at the middle of the page on 7.18, there's a provision that if a party requests that a guardian ad litem be appointed to represent or at least advise to protect the interests of a party, that the court should consider appointing one pursuant to the rules of civil procedure. The next section, section 5 at the bottom of 7, this provides for clarity on when a court can extend an IRPO and describing the elements that must be satisfied to a court to extend the length of an IRPO that's already been imposed on a respondent. And then moving to the top of page 8, there is a new provision, which would allow for an IRPO to be imposed for up to 5 years if the respondent has violated a prior or an existing extreme risk protection order on two or more occasions, or the respondent is or has been subject to two or more extreme risk protection orders in the past. The next changes on 8.8 through 8.7, they contain some clarifying language to remove the word terminate and replace it with vacate. And then they provide some guidance to the court when the petitioner or respondent asks for an order to be vacated. If that's denied, they can come back to the court for 6 months to request another vacation of the order. Moving on to section 6 at the bottom of page 8, clarifies the information regarding hearings that must be provided to a respondent when an emergency IRPO is served, and that those changes carry on to the next page 9 in that section 6. Section 7 amends the section related to transfer of firearms for IRPOs. And this requires firearms dealers and law enforcement agencies to establish policies for disposal of firearms, but removes the requirement that law enforcement notify a respondent prior to disposing of an abandoned firearm. It also eliminates the obligation of law enforcement to reimburse a respondent for permanently transferred firearms, as Representative Frazier indicated. The section further repeals the prohibition on law enforcement charging a respondent for processing fees for storage of firearms, those that are temporarily transferred. Further, it establishes that respondents are responsible for filing any proofs of transfer and declarations of non-possession with the court, as opposed to the law enforcement agency filing those on their behalf. And then finally, it grants immunity from prosecution for unlawful possession of a firearm to an ERPO respondent who voluntarily surrenders their firearms. So if they were, even if they were in unlawful possession of it prior to receiving the ERPO, if they voluntarily surrendered, this would extend them some immunity for prosecution for having that firearm before the order was issued. Section 8 on the bottom of 11 clarifies that a law enforcement agency shall not return temporarily transferred firearms to a respondent if the respondent did not lawfully possess the firearms prior to surrendering them. And then sections 9, 10, and 11 contain either technical or conforming changes for the other provisions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Debo. And I believe you have somebody here to answer questions if needed, Chair Frazier. And otherwise, we had one member of the public sign up to testify, and that was Roger Day. If you're in the room, if you could make your way to the testifier table, please. Welcome to the committee, and before you begin, please state your name for the record, and we'll have 2 minutes for your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Roger Day, and as a preliminary matter, before I begin my 2 minutes of testimony, I've been requesting a disability accommodation to be provided with an expanded amount of time due to my disability, that you will better receive my information if I am not forced to race against a clock. And I've been working to explain that disability to the state for many years now, and the state routinely bails out of the conversation, does not actually entertain my disability accommodation requests. And so I am here as a victim of disability discrimination that is just horrendous. And so it makes it really hard to be helpful to this process. And so I'm going to do my best to get clear, good information to you in a very reasonable amount of time. But it's made harder by the disability discrimination that I suffer. So with that, let me say that overall, I do support this these changes to this legislation. The statute was enacted in quite a rush just a couple years ago, and it still has some fundamental problems and some technical problems. And I'll have more to say about the fundamental problems when it goes to judiciary. I think for this meeting, it's important to recognize that there is a distinction in the practice of law between criminal cases and cases in equity. And this whole process is set up within the case in equity framework. This is about domestic violence. It's about a situation between two people. It's not about public safety broadly. And certainly if one person is being violent towards another, that is a public safety threat. But the challenge is that here a judge is required to assess whether that threat is actually large enough to restrict the person's constitutional right. And so it moves it completely outside of the realm of equity and moves it into the realm of criminality. And so if you're going to take away somebody's Second Amendment right, you really ought to put them on trial for their violence and not just make findings at hearing based on information between two opposing civil parties. So that's a fundamental flaw in the whole framework. And some of the guidance that's offered in this statute actually makes the situation worse, and the corrections being offered here make it a little better. So it's a complicated deal. But on subdivision 2, relief by the court, actually tells the court what it ought to consider as evidence. And of course, that's the court knows what is evidence and what isn't, and so it really isn't necessary.
Yep, Dr. Day, your time is up, and I did allow you to go over your time limits.
But what's really important here,
Dr. Day, your time limit is up, and I did allow you to go over by quite a bit, actually.
Well, so, Representative Frazier, I can
your
work
time
with
is
you
up, Dr. Day. Yes. Thank you.
So, again, it's really.
All right. Thank you so much. Please step away from the microphone right now.
So
your time is up, and you're out of order to keep talking over the chair.
Yes.
You will have an opportunity in another committee.
You were abusive.
You are out of order. Members, we will move on to committee discussion. And I will remind the committee that we are debating the bill language before us, not the underlying extreme risk protection order law that was passed a couple of years ago. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, as usual, always great to see you in this committee. I miss you.
I miss you too.
lines 10.1 through 10.5, you're deleting the language that requires a law enforcement agency to compensate the respondent at fair market value when they are permanently transferring a firearm. Has any discussion or thought been given to how that jives with the Fifth Amendment takings clause that private property taken for public use needs to have just compensation?
And Representative Hudson, can you? I didn't hear what lines you were referring to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lines 10.1 through 10.5.
All right, go ahead, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hudson, yeah, we have thought about that. This came about with conversation with law enforcement. It does create a barrier for them to receive these firearms. That's why we still allow the option for those folks to return those. They can still turn those firearms into a firearms dealer to hold those weapons for them, and those firearm dealers are allowed to either they can sell those weapons and then compensate the individual, or they can directly compensate the individual when they take that firearm in. So we still provide for a process for them to turn those weapons over to a firearms dealer that could purchase it from them directly or sell it and then provide compensation for the weapon if that is the choosing of that individual.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. So is it your intention then that there is no circumstance under this change of language whereby someone's property would be confiscated without just compensation?
Representative Frazier.
They will have the weapon returned to them once the petition is no longer in effect.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussions, questions? Representative Pinto.
Madam Chair, I was going to violate your directive about not talking about the underlying orders, and I guess I'll just reiterate how effective they've been, and I'm grateful to Chair Frazier for his work as a past author of these orders. I think we can be very proud of the work that we've done and appreciate the improvement that is represented in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Navani, or Chair Navani, sorry.
It all works. Representative Frazier, walk me through so we all understand what's the current timeline for these firearms to be surrendered to a law enforcement agency, and what will you change it to? So we're all on the same page.
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Co-Chair, Rep. Novotny, thank you for the question. Currently now, once the petition is approved by the judge, you have 24 hours to submit those firearms to law enforcement or to a licensed firearm provider.
Chair Novotny.
And what would they you know, so you get a notice, you have 24 hours to turn them in, and what would it go to under the provisions of this bill?
That remains
the same. Frazier.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Co-Chair Novotny, that timeline remains the same.
That remains the same.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry. So, and going back to the questions that Representative Hudson touched on 10.1 through 10.5. So, explain again, how does that work? If the respondent permanently transfers to the law enforcement agency, the agency must compensate the respondent at fair market value and may not charge the respondent any processing or other fees. Now that's being struck. So what will it be now?
Representative Frazier.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Sorry, Chair Novotny. Can you repeat that? I didn't hear the last part.
If we strike lines from the middle of 10.2 through 10.5, what will happen to those firearms that have been permanently transferred?
Representative Frazier.
That have been permanently transferred?
Well, we have the language that's currently in the bill on 10.2 through 10.5, and this bill strikes that. So what happens to those firearms that are in possession of the law enforcement agencies?
Representative Frazier.
That have been permanently transferred. You're saying the individuals will not reclaim those firearms once the petition has been resolved.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Yes, so they get this order, and you've got a law enforcement agency that's going to be holding these weapons for an extended period of time, and address that specifically. How many years will, under this order, will they be sitting on these weapons?
Representative Frazier.
They will have the weapons for as long as the petition is in place. Once that petition is no longer in place, those weapons will be returned to the individual.
Chair Novotny.
Chair Mueller, thank you. So, but there's a timeline. What is the timeline?
Mr. Frazier.
Madam Chair, so you're asking what is the timeline, how long a petition could be in place?
Yes.
A petition could be in place for up to 12 months. It could be in place for longer if there's a determination by the courts that the threat or concern is still in place, still valid.
Chair Novotny.
It's a large amount of firearms. So if it's your contention that with this language, and make sure I understand this perfectly, that no firearms will be, if they're transferred to the law enforcement agency, there still will be an opportunity for the people to reclaim those weapons after the order expires.
That is correct.
Chair Novotny.
And what if they don't?
Representative Frazier.
What if they do not reclaim those weapons?
Yes.
I would. So it, I think Chief Potts, can you come up for a second? I'm asking Chief Potts to come up because we've had these conversations around some of the issues that have been happening with law enforcement, with holding on to some of these firearms, with the fair market piece, and you may be able to speak to those details.
Thank you. Chair Mueller.
Yeah, I'll just say welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here, Chief Potts, to answer these questions. And go ahead, Chair Novotny.
Let me rephrase it, and I keep pulling at the string because I was hoping to get an answer. There are people that after they've had this emergency protection order that won't be able to reclaim their firearms because of the statuses of their cases and things like that. What happens to them is what I was trying to get at eventually.
Chief Potts, if you could introduce yourself too for the record before you answer the question.
Madam Chair and Chair Novotny, so just to clarify, the respondent at this time, according to current law, has the choice on where the firearms will be stored. You can go to a federal firearms dealer, or they can go to the law enforcement agency. What this provision 10.5 does is if they choose to surrender the firearms, meaning they never want them back pursuant to this order, that the agency no longer has the obligation to compensate them at fair market value. Now, while the order is in effect, and if they chose the law enforcement option, they sit in a property room for the duration of the order. Someone can come claim them. The person can come claim them once the order expires. That can currently, The orders are in effect for 12 months. This, there's a provision in this that can be extended, I believe, up to 5 years pursuant to additional information. It's our understanding what happens in those cases, if that were to become law, is those firearms simply stay in the property room at the agency where they're being, where, you know, at the agency who served the order.
And Chief Potts, if you could just introduce yourself for the record, too.
I apologize. Jeff Potts, Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association.
Thank you. Chair Novotny?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Would they be able to transfer that firearm to an FFL during this order while it's still in effect?
Can we, Madam Chair, refer to House Research to clarify the transfer provisions within the bill or within the underlying statute?
Yes, so if I'm understanding the question correctly, it's if the person has originally had their firearms stored at the law enforcement agency and wants to then have them move to an FFL instead. For example, if they're going to be permanently, if they're permanently relinquishing them, or is that right?
That is correct, Chair.
Okay. Mr. Deeble.
Madam Chair and members, under existing law, the local law enforcement agency shall, upon written notice from the respondent, transfer the firearms to a federally licensed firearms dealer.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Frazier, moving on to line 11.12 through 11.13. It is your language about immunity for someone that turns in their weapons. Now, I agree that this provision is on its face value a good idea, that it would encourage them to turn in firearms that family members might know that they have, but they may not be lawfully in possession of. What happens now through language that this committee has passed in the distant, recent past, every weapon coming into that evidence room is going to be run. What happens if we give them immunity for turning the weapon in for an unlawful possession, but we find out that this weapon has been used in another incident that is much more serious?
Before you answer that, I guess I would just ask for clarity on what law you're referring to about every weapon coming in has to be tested.
Every weapon recovered right now gets run through next.
I'm not sure it does through ERPO, though. I guess maybe that's a question for, I don't know who can answer that. If that's nonpartisan or looks like there's some discussion going on. Representative Steer.
It's pretty much a department policy. So you execute a search warrant, you collect a handgun or firearm, then you run the firearm through NCIC to make sure that it's not stolen, and then check it into your evidence room, and it belongs to the right person.
Okay. Representative Frazier.
The way I would interpret the practical application of this would be that the immunity would be for not violating the ERPO statute for turning over weapons that you may have, not immunity for cases that you may have committed or that you may have committed with that weapon that were found out if they're being tested by that local law enforcement agency.
Chair Novotny.
It still gives me concerns that we might be missing cases and having things come up that would result with the current language that's here. I'd like to see that changed.
Yeah, and Chair Novotny, I think there is a way that that language could certainly be tightened up to reflect that we're not talking about other cases or other charges. It's just for the act of ERPO and immunity for that. Chair
Thank
Frazier.
You, Madam Chair. And Chair Novotny, I would absolutely be willing to clarify that.
Chair Novotny.
That will be fine for now.
Oh, were there others? Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Frazier. Great to see you. Appreciate the bill trying to get the guns out of the people that are in crisis and other events like that. Do you know to date how many ERPOs have been given out?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last report that I've seen, there were 280, but that was toward the end of last year. I would imagine there have been more this year. I don't have the exact number. And I do have, Raina Alexandra is in the audience. She may have that. She's the coordinator for ERPOLs for Hennepin County. She may have that data.
Representative Woody.
Thank you. I was just curious seeing where it all was coming through and if it was being an effective tool through the different areas and where we have to strengthen it. And then the last question is, do you have a fiscal note? Do we know if there's going to be anything tied to this, or is it just a language tie?
I think Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not have a fiscal note. I don't believe there's going to be a cost, but we have an, we do have another stop, so we could request a fiscal note.
Further questions, discussions?
Just real quick.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I usually see if my questions have been asked before this, but they haven't been. So I was looking at, you're changing the meaning of family or household members to section 518B.01. And in 518B.01, it has former people that you've lived with in the past, persons who are presently residing together or have resided together in the past. Is there a timeline on that? I mean, I'm 61 years old. Is my 20-year-old roommate from, you know, back in 1980, does that, can he turn one of these in?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't believe we have a timeline, but because these cases have to be presented to a judge will be able to take that information into consideration.
Representative Bliss.
Okay.
Anything else? Yep. Thank Representative Steer.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's just one of the things with ERPOL that has kind of rubbed me the wrong way is the 24-hour period of time. So we're essentially giving the person 24 hours to figure out a way to either attack law enforcement or turn over their weapons. So would you be opposed to just removing the 24-hour delay and having it immediately?
Representative Frazier.
Representative Steer, thank you for that question. I would be open to looking at that. I did have concerns about pushback we may get around due process, but I would absolutely be open to looking at that.
Okay. Representative Steer, anything else? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Frazier. I'm trying to see over here. Thank you so much for the bill. I know there's been some discussion about underlying definitions and other areas of law. We could certainly talk about that. Some perhaps issues with the underlying law that has been passed before. Again, I know you're open always to that conversation. I appreciate it. I think from what I'm hearing from this conversation today is that there's a lot of really, really good, smart things that we've learned since enacting this that is going to improve and make this better. And I really appreciate that you're open to making even more changes on your way to judiciary. And I hope that we can do that today, and I'd like to ask for a roll call to do that. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Chair Novotny?
Yes, Chair Moeller. As there are a bunch of questions, there are a lot of things we'd like to work on for this. I think it needs to go to judiciary and get these things cleared up. There are many things in the language that we agree with that we agree with the chiefs that this should be good, and I would recommend to move it on to judiciary, where we hope to get these things fixed. And you can still do the voice vote if you want, but
okay.
I mean, still can do the roll call, but we have concerns about some of these things that we just like to get cleaned up, but we can't do that without it going to judiciary.
Thank you. Representative Curran, would you be willing to remove the request for a roll call?
I would. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for the good questions. Thank you for your willingness to, as always, to continue working on these bills. It's great to have you back in committee. Chair Frazier, any closing remarks?
It's good to be here. Always good to be here. To members that have questions, please send those to me as soon as you can through email. We can work on those. I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation on the way to judiciary. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. I renew the motion to re-refer House File 3658 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. All right. The next bill is House File 3453. It's a Representative Hansen bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen. I will move to recommend that House File 3453
be placed on the general register, and I don't see that you have any amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Chair Novotny and members, and to everyone who has signed on to this bill, I appreciate the enthusiasm. Whether you've heard it called Kratom or Kratom, both are considered correct. House File 3453 increases the age to purchase it or possess it from 18 to 21. This is a straightforward, common sense approach to the first step toward better regulating Kratom. This product is widely available in communities throughout the state, from gas stations to tobacco stores and more. In 2018, the Minnesota legislature passed its first law regulating Kratom in Minnesota, requiring a person to be 18 to buy it. Over the last few legislative sessions, 15 other states have passed laws setting 21 as the minimum age for purchase and possession. Minnesota consistently sets 21 as the age for purchasing and possessing regulated substances like alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis. And House File 3453 raises Kratom to that same requirement. I've been gathering a coalition of stakeholders to continue conversations about additional responsible regulations, and these efforts will go through the commerce channels in the coming sessions. I hope to have the initial framework dropped in a bill before session ends, or at least have language available for interesting parties to review, so if that's you, you'll know where to find me. My regulations will propose addressing regulating licenses, labeling, liabilities, location, and the look of both packaging and advertisements. But for now, the bill before you will simply raise the minimum age to align with the age we've set for tobacco, alcohol, and cannabis. And Chair, I have some testifiers who can provide some more background as well. Thank you.
Great. And I believe you have two testifiers. If you want to make your way to the testifier table, please. And then before you begin your testimony, if you want to, or not want to, you do need to introduce yourself for the record. And I'm not sure which one of you wants to go first. So whoever wants to go first, please begin. And you have been given 2 minutes each.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Josh Nye. I'm a lobbyist representing Change the Outcome. Thank you for allowing me to speak in favor of Representative Hansen's House File 3453, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for starting this conversation. Kratom is a plant that affects the opioid receptors in the brain. It has the potential to be more than just a harmless herbal product. It has stimulant and opioid-like effects that can cause dependence, withdrawal, and has other serious health risks. Kratom is sold in gas stations and convenience stores as pills, powder, or as a drink. It's sold under names like Feel Free, Sunshine Hippo, or Space Bird. Kratom is not federally approved or regulated in the United States as a drug, dietary supplement, or food additive. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has also found that some Kratom products contain lead and nickel at concentrations that exceed daily human exposure limits. Kratom's two main compounds, mitragynine and 7-hydromitragynine, or 7-OH, affect the brain like an opioid does. 7-OH can be almost as potent as morphine. Because Kratom's active compounds vary in strength from product to product, the dose a person receives can be unpredictable. Its easy accessibility, unpredictable makeup and potency, and lack of regulation for consumers make Kratom particularly risky for young people. Raising the age to purchase Kratom is a step in the right direction, and I look forward to continued conversations. Please support House File 3453. Thank you.
Thank you, and please do not make us say the chemical name for this. Well done.
I'm learning. 7-OH is great.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Yes. My name is Colleen Ronnie. I am the Executive Director of Change the Outcome, which is a nonprofit that has delivered substance use prevention education to more than 170,000 middle and high school students across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to speak in favor of House File 3453, and I'm grateful to Representative Hansen's willingness to work toward legislation to safeguard Minnesota's youth from the risks posed by Kratom. The letters in your packet, as well as the current packaging of Kratom products, extol the virtues of Kratom as a natural botanical that, when consumed responsibly, frames Kratom as a harmless alternative to pharmaceutical options for managing pain, anxiety, or depression. Coca plants and opium poppy plants are also natural botanicals that are used to produce risk-laden substances. I think everyone in this room understands that the dangers these botanicals would bring if they were being sold in gas stations and smoke shops. My staff regularly observe kids buying kratom products in gas stations when they're traveling to schools across the state. In my work with young people, I see firsthand how easily they are influenced by legal and accessible and safe substances. Minnesota has a critical opportunity to prevent an additional public health crisis like the opioid epidemic by installing guardrails on a substance that is easily obtained by youth and often serves as a perfect legal alternative to those seeking an escape from their pain and mental health struggles. Raising the legal purchase age of kratom from 18 to 21 is a vital first step in reducing kratom's harm on Minnesota, on Minnesotans. From a personal perspective, I can assure you that my 20-year-old son, whom we lost to the opioid epidemic, would have battled daily to resist a product sold at a neighborhood gas station that promised to replicate the relief he sought from fentanyl or OxyContin. I hope that you will please support House File 3453. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for your continued advocacy for all youth in Minnesota. Very much appreciated. And I think we have two other members who signed up to testify, or members of the public. First is Mr. Haddo, and I don't know if you're in the room. You are, so you're making your way to the table. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. And again, you've been given 2 minutes of testimony. Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Mueller, members of the committee, my name is Matt Haddo, Senior Fellow on Public Policy with the American Kratom Association. 24 million people consume kratom responsibly and safely in the United States, and hundreds of thousands here in Minnesota, many of whom asked me to fly in here today in order to testify in support of this age restriction. And as a former legislator, I know when to quit when you're ahead, but I would like to add one additional point that I think is important. On July 29th of 2025, FDA Commissioner McCary publicly announced that there was a problem in the kratom space with products that were being represented and sold as kratom. Here's an example of one. It's called an advanced kratom alkaloid. It is 7-OH. It is a chemically manipulated product that is not kratom, and yet it is marketed as kratom, deceiving consumers above the age of 21, and we think there's a simple regulatory fix that you could make. Here's another 7-OH product. It is a sublingual strip. It is designed to bypass your gastro system, which is the way natural kratom works, and it goes right to your mu opioid receptors, gets you addicted, and it has high addiction potential and death. And here's MGM-1516, the latest iteration. I bought these, and when they were purchased 3 weeks ago and sent to the American Kratom Association's offices. They don't care. And this is a total chemically manipulated product, 100 milligrams of a chemical product that will get you addicted and kill you. And that's what the FDA is advocating for. We support the age 21, and then with some appropriate regulatory framework, protect those above 21 from these unsafe products. Natural doesn't mean safe. We believe in regulations. 20 states have done so. Responsibly hope Minnesota will join them. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And we also have Annette Peters, who's with us virtually. If you want to unmute yourself and begin your testimony. It looks like you are unmuted already.
Yeah.
Welcome.
My name is Annette Peters. I'm a registered nurse and the Minnesota chair for the American Kratom Association. I was going to talk about what Mac was talking about, but I'll skip that now. I participated in 2000. By the way, I submitted my testimony to you guys by email, so you'll have that to read. But I just wanted to highlight a few things. In 2023, I assisted with Bill HF-1066, which is the Kratom Consumer Protection Act. This is passed in 19 different states. We don't have it passed here in 23. It died in committee. I don't know exactly what that means, but I think that the Kratom Consumer Protection Act is being developed now again. What this does is it has manufacturing guidelines for people that want to purchase the natural Kratom leaf product. It requires lab testing and labeling guidelines. and it keeps synthetics and other chemicals and other drugs out of what you're purchasing. This is extremely important to keep Minnesotans safe. Also, what I submitted to you guys, and Ellen McDaniels was so helpful to help me to submit this, but in 2018, there was going to be a scheduling of Kratom, and I submitted 50 testimonies from a broad range of people that use natural Kratom products. Please read their personal stories. And also, there's a bill being proposed to schedule Kratom as Schedule II drug. The Factor VIII analysis does not support this. In fact, it recommends regulation, but not scheduling Kratom. It's not appropriate for it. So anyway, being that the synthetics are on the rise, I think this is so important what the FDA is doing with, because there's a difference between the natural Kratom product, Kratom leaf product, and the synthesized drugs and chemicals that are being sold in smoke shops and in gas stations. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And yes, Ellen McDaniel is amazing and did provide a packet of that information that you submitted. It's in our packets. Thank you. Members, that's all we have for testimony. So we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen. I don't really have a policy question, but I am curious how this issue came on your radar. It seems like a pretty obscure one. I'm sure there's probably a story there.
Go ahead, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I was the bill that was mentioned was House File 1066 was my bill from last session. It's interesting because I've got a lot of people in my life who have had conversations about this, and I have a 21-year-old daughter and around a lot of kids her age, and asking them, like, would you take this if you heard that it did these things? And a lot said, yeah. I said, what if I told you it was addictive? Oh, I would, no, I don't want to do that. And so I think young people want to be fully informed of that. And so while we work on that regulation and hopefully build a good, nice, strong stakeholder crew to do so, this was just the first step to get there.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this forward. I don't think I have a question as much as I have a comment, because I really appreciate that we're trying to get ahead of this and address it before it becomes a problem. I have two young kids, and I feel like every other week I'm having to go over what's now available at gas stations and what they should not be doing, even though it's easily accessible. And so making sure that we have legislation in place that restricts ages and makes it more difficult to get is really important. Frankly, I don't think this goes as far as I would like to see it go, but I know that we can address that in future dates. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for this bill. I actually do support it. I think we need to take it a little bit further with derivatives on all of these natural substances that are coming through, because they are synthetic, and it might be a derivative of a natural plant, but they're changing it so much that it's actually affecting a lot of people, and especially the kids, at a drastic rate. I mean, the poison control has drastically increased with calls on this stuff. That is huge, that people don't know how to react to it and what we should do. So these synthetics are really bad for our community, and we need to rein this in. I just don't know how, but I'm in full support of this. It's going to, I think, help a lot of people. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative. For bringing this forward. My question is why is it sold in gas stations? I guess I'm a little concerned. I'm obviously supportive of it and having access to it, not even just up to the age of 21, that maybe there has to be different channels that if there's troubles with the way it's, but I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that question. It's a good question, because it can be. and state law allows it to be. And so that's why I mentioned in my potential future work, like I hope to have done by the end of this year, I want to address, I'm trying to make it easy for people to remember, right? The license, the label, the liability, the location, and the look, and trying to make sure that we're addressing that. And so the location, liability, and the licensing piece of it should address what you're looking at. But I think a lot of folks agree that is the gas station the best place? I guess we'll find out as we continue that work on what smart regulation looks like here. And I happen to know a thing or two about regulating unregulated products in Minnesota. So I'm hoping that I can bring that expertise to the table too.
Thank you. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing this bill. And first off, question, you had the bill that would make it a Schedule 1. Are you still planning on pursuing that?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Novotny. It's a Schedule 2 is my other bill. It's 3452 right before this one. Nice and easy to remember. That's a complicated conversation for folks to have. I wanted to at least initiate the conversation on both of these items this year and really start to build the stakeholder group around a regulatory team that we could all get on the same page about. It's before your committee, I believe, and so I will leave that up to you, oh wise ones, to decide that.
Yeah, and I'll just state that that one would also requires a stop in the health committee. It potentially has a cost, so we were trying to factor everything in and really thought that this was the bill that we wanted to make sure we heard before deadline, but you know, we both have a gavel too, so certainly something we're willing to entertain.
I thank you, Chair. I was just going to encourage you in the next session to pursue that with the people that are still, you know, here. That is something important. Given the various levels of or various means of ingestion that they're doing, I think it's really important that we get that a little more regulated. And I can't imagine people snorting or smoking something that you get from a gas station that's unregulated. And I believe that's a very big part of the problem that we're seeing from these addictions. And with that, I encourage a yes vote.
And thank you so much, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill. And if you would like to make some closing comments, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. And again, thank you to everybody who signed on. This is a relatively new conversation, and so I know it can be difficult to have those, but I stand ready to talk about regulation in the next session and hope that you'll join me in working on that, because it'll take everybody to really do what we need to do to make sure people are informed. And informed consent is a really important thing when we have these products out there. So thank you.
Thanks again. I renew the motion to recommend that House File 3453 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Right. Next up, we have House File 3358. It's a Representative Finke bill. I will move to recommend that House File 3358 be placed on the general register. And I do see Representative Finke. First of all, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
And I do see that you have the DE2 author's amendment. So I will move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in. Did you want to comment on the DE now or after we adopt and you explain the bill?
After is fine.
All right. Any discussion to the DE2 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 amendment is adopted. All right, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Novotny, and members of the committee. It's lovely to be back with you so soon. This is a pretty simple bill. It just does a couple of things around the transport and detention of people by law enforcement. It essentially says that if you are going to detain individuals, you must do so in a vehicle that is designed for moving people and is marked as a law enforcement vehicle. This bill came to me last summer when we saw agents in California use a Penske moving truck to detain individuals at a Home Depot. And when I saw that happening, I was flashed back to, if we remember, the death of Freddie Gray, who was detained in a law enforcement vehicle in 2015, chained to the floor and not in a vehicle that was meant to move people. And he ended up passing away. He died from his injuries in that transport. That happened again in 2022 to a person named Randy Cox, who was put in the back of a van that ended up costing him his life because he was not detained safely and transported in a vehicle meant to move people. There's another similar story currently under investigation right now in St. Louis. So I think it's not too much to ask, right? If you're going to put people into a vehicle and you're going to transport them, we should do so in a vehicle that is meant to transport people. I will just say before I turn it over, we did bring this bill to DPS for comment by BCA and State Patrol, and that's why we have the DE amendment. We made two changes at the request of the Department of Public Safety. One was just to make sure that we peace officer is a Minnesota statutory word, and they just wanted to make sure it didn't get confused with the federal part of the bill. So we're happy to change that. And then we also had the term seatbelt in the bill. But DPS uses buses to transport people that do not have seatbelts, and that, of course, is not our intention to get in the way of. It's simply to say you must put people in vehicles meant to move people. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I do see you have some letters in the packets, but you don't have a testifier, and nobody from the public has signed up to testify. So we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this bill forward. I think this is a really common sense measure. You know, again, as a parent, like, I require my kids to be in cars and vehicles that are designed for people to be transported safely, and that's what I would wish for any person. You know, I think I certainly grew up doing some crazy crap and being in the trunk of cars and in the back of pickup trucks and whatnot in rural areas. But I think it's the least that we can do to expect our peace officers and law enforcement to be transporting people in a safe manner, especially given the fact that, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. And a lot of people who get picked up and transported by peace officer vehicles are in fact found innocent. And people don't deserve to die because they get picked up by law enforcement. So I would hope that there would be robust support for this provision, for this bill, also from law enforcement, because it's their goal to keep people alive and to serve and protect the people of Minnesota as well. So thank you.
Further member discussion. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. What is the enforcement mechanism for actually making sure that this bill, if it were to ever become law, which I don't see happening, that it actually is followed through on and there's some sort of enforcement?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Ingen. The bill does not have an enforcement mechanism. The bill is legislating our law enforcement to behave in a certain manner. This is a well within the right of our legislature to do, and it's just, I guess it is my hope that the law enforcement agencies will follow the laws.
Representative Ingen.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. You can open one hand to do something in another, but this doesn't sound like there's going to be any enforcement mechanism or anything else. So thank you so much.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm confused by the line of questioning. I mean, first, I guess I trust our law enforcement to follow the law. And when they don't, there's certainly mechanisms in place civilly and even if necessary criminally. But in general, if we pass a law, we expect that law enforcement is going to follow it. And the enforcement mechanism is the same as any other laws that we pass. So I guess I don't see any concern about that with this and appreciate the substance of what we're going for here to keep people safe. Thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing it forward.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, setting aside for the time being the specific calling out of federal agents and the whole Supremacy Clause conversation that we've had ad nauseum, are there any examples of law enforcement agencies at the state or local level here in Minnesota that are not currently aligned with the intent of this bill?
Representative Finke.
I do not have Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hudson. I don't have immediately in front of me examples of individuals who are doing that. We can set aside what happened under occupation, but I do believe that it is relevant, and we are more than allowed to regulate all governments equally. So we certainly know that individuals are detained in unmarked cars and in rental cars and in personal vehicles throughout the last several months. And while I would like us to not be doing that, I don't have individual examples of the kind of tragedies that I cited at the beginning.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. So, okay, moving back then to the federal agent component, to Representative Ingen's point, when we talk about enforcement mechanism, we're talking about the capacity of state authorities to enforce our statutes on federal officers who are engaged in their official duties, which would seem to run directly contrary to well-established precedent under the Supremacy Clause. What would your response to that be?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hudson. I would say that this runs very far in line with the Supremacy Clause. We're not asking the federal agents to do something separate from what we ask our local and state officials to do, and we are not asking them to do something that interferes with the core duty, which is the detention of, in this example, immigrants. If the bill said that they were not allowed to detain immigrants, then we would have a Supremacy Clause issue, but given the Supremacy Clause allows us to regulate all governments equally and allows us not to interfere, as long as we are not interfering with the core duties, we can pass those laws. So I actually think not doing so is quite irresponsible for us to just assume that we have no power. The reason that the republic that we serve is set up as it is to ensure that the overreach of the federal government is not out of control. States have the right, and we actually have a long history of supporting that right to determine how they are governed. I'm not trying to interfere. This has nothing to do with federal immigration enforcement. It has to do with what kind of car you can move people in and whether or not you can do that in a Penske truck. And if we can't agree that we should not move people in Penske trucks, then we're having a different conversation.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. I guess I would just point to the language in line 1.6, 1.7, where the definition of federal agent means an officer or agent of a federal law enforcement agency or any person acting on behalf of a federal law enforcement agency. If they're doing that, obviously they're acting in their official capacity, and then the lines 110 and 111, the prohibition is that if a peace officer or federal agent, as defined, needs to detain or transport a person in a vehicle, the vehicle must, and then it goes on to list the qualifiers. Well, if a federal agent needs to detain or transport a person, that's because they're engaged in their official duties, which would seem to, again, run completely afoul of the plain understanding of the Supremacy Clause. Madam Chair, I'll ask for a roll call, and I have one more quick question. In lines 114 and 115, the requirement that the vehicle must contain conspicuous markings that identify the law enforcement agency that owns or leases the vehicle, if the overriding concern here is safety, what's the safety component of ensuring that vehicles are conspicuously marked?
Representative Finke.
I believe it's a deeply concerning issue to the safety of someone if you put them in a car that doesn't indicate who's taking them away. That to me is people are abducted and put into cars, right? If you are detaining someone as a law enforcement member, that the law enforcement agency doing that detention, that should be on the vehicle, so your family knows who to call, so people know where you're going to be detained.
All right, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. I appreciate that this
while obviously does, you know, relate to events that have happened in Minnesota, but events that happen across the country. That's nothing unique to the work that we do in this body, responding to problems that we see arise in other states so that we can prevent them from happening in states like ours here in Minnesota. And I think it's perfectly appropriate for us to set standards in Minnesota for how people will be treated, regardless of policy differences with the federal government. I think when we look at how we treat people in Minnesota, how we respect due process of law, how we respect the humanity of human beings, I'm glad that we have a roll call on this, because it is just unacceptable to me that Minnesota would be fine with setting a standard that it's okay to throw any human being in the back of a moving truck like cargo or cattle. So I'll be gladly voting in support.
All right, members, we have at least four members on the list, and I want to make sure that we have time for the final bill. I know there are a number of folks in the audience here related to the final bill that we have on the agenda today. So with that, Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a couple real quick questions kind of listening to this. First, I'm a firm believer of not reinventing the wheel, and let's make the wheel spin faster and more efficient. Are there any other states that have this law currently in existence?
Representative Finke.
Maybe that's a House.
Representative Finke.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I did research comparable laws, and states have a wide variety, patchwork of laws around vehicle transport and detention and markings. This is not within, this is a very reasonably positioned within those range of vehicle laws for law enforcement.
Representative Rapinski. Follow up?
Is that a no? Or yeah, I didn't.
There's a yes. I'm understanding that there's a range of statutes that cover
this type of thing. This law specifically that we're asking to make, is this law applied to any other states?
Are you asking this very exact same language or any language related? Because what I understood the answer to be was that there are other states that have language related to whether or not how cars can be used in transporting people and whether they must be marked or not. So
thank you, Madam Chair. My specific question is, the way we're going to write this, is there any other states that have this existing verbiage pertaining to this specific law on the books currently?
So I guess the question is, in this exact same language, does it exist in any other state? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I actually reject form bills. I think that we should not take language from other bills and apply it exactly into statute. I think that's a bad practice. So I would say probably no. This was language that I created, or actually that House nonpartisan wrote in conjunction with myself and others.
Representative Rapinski.
Okay, thank you. And the other quick question I have is, you cited some examples in other states where there was injuries from transport of detained people. What kind of injuries did those people suffer that they lost their life in the transport? Like, what was the actual injury?
Yeah, Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the question. So in 2015, Freddie Gray was shackled and his wrists were bound, and then he was tied to the floor of a van. And then when that van was driving, it braked and he slid forward and broke his neck and later died. Randy Cox in 2022 in New Haven, Connecticut was in the back of a truck when that truck slammed on the brakes and he hit his head and died. And Mark Smith, who is current, this one's still investigation in St. Louis, was having a mental break and was detained and injured himself in the back of a vehicle because he was not restrained and died.
Representative Rapinski, you can make this your last question or comment.
Thank
please.
You. Yeah, so I guess my thought process, I'm just trying to think this through, is if a vehicle then has seat belts, is that an okay vehicle?
Representative Finke.
Yes, if a vehicle has seat belts, it is designed for the transport of the safe transport of individuals.
Okay.
All right. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Chair Finke, I just have a couple questions. One part is if a peace officer on 1.10, if a peace officer or federal agent needs to detain or transport a person, and transport can mean they're picking them up and taking them somewhere. And then 1.14 contains markings that identify the law enforcement agency that owns or leases the vehicle. My example would be, and I'd be curious if you've talked to the sheriffs, the chiefs of police, or MPPOA or Lells about it, but the problem becomes when you pick up a juvenile and you bring them, the BCA has unmarked vehicles with no markings on them. Most of our law enforcement vehicles, investigators, sheriffs, and police departments have unmarked vehicles, and a lot of times they're recommended to take a juvenile back to the PD that way. They do have seat belts, but they don't have the markings. They will have the lights and other pieces. So I guess we're trying to figure out where we're trying to put this into. The other part is if another agency flies into the Twin Cities to do a transport back to their state because they have someone that's on a detainer, and they rent the car, and they go pick them up, and then go back to the airport, put them on the plane. Do they need markings for that? And they didn't, you know, they rented the car. They're not leasing. They're not owning them. So it can have some fallback things. And a lot of times, I think, with the juveniles, where I'm trying to get with that is, you know, bring them in a vehicle that might make it a little not in the back of a squad car. And you have more of the seatbelts, or you can put booster chairs in the back of it. So, you know, State Patrol has these type of vehicles, too. And one of them in particular, it does have no markings, and it has undercover members driving them, is the governor's detail. And they're transporting them from point A to point B. So I guess my viewpoint is if you've reached out to those agencies, because I think there's a little bit of gaps in here for you.
Yeah, and before I turn about, I'll just say that there are exceptions that begin on line 1.16 and end on line 1.20. Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Woody, for your question. I do believe that the exceptions meet most of the examples that you raise, but I am very interested in what you're saying about minors. I do believe that minors might be an exception that also should be included, because I agree with you that if we can reduce the trauma and the harm that can come with, you know, having a squad car roll up and, you know, having to be taken away, that's real. So I really appreciate that. You know, this is but we did reach out to the law enforcement, right? And those law enforcement agencies, you know, what you have in front of you is the reflection of the feedback that they gave me. So with the exception of that minors, I do believe that the bill represents those concerns.
Representative Duran.
Sounds good.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will be brief. And I'm disappointed that Representative Hudson walked out of the room, because I was just going to respond to him. It feels like there are two questions in front of us. Can Minnesota do this? And should we do this? And I think solidly the law is with us that we can. This treats everybody the same. And while I hear the Supremacy Clause cited a lot, the 10th Amendment, which is the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the, are reserved to the states. And the police powers are quintessentially state powers, which this is dealing with. So we absolutely can do this. And should we do this? And I think we have also heard all the reasons why, yes, this is just good common sense policing. It's good common sense to have both marked vehicles and also vehicles that are made to design to transport people. So this feels like a really easy choice, and I really appreciate Representative Finke you bringing it, because it is in real response to what we've seen in other states and also what we've seen in the last couple of months. But yes, we can do this, and yes, we should do this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'll just note that Representative Hudson just walked in right after you got done saying what you said to address his concerns. So maybe you could share that with him offline.
Happy to.
All right. And let's see. We've got Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Finke, have you asked for a fiscal note on this bill?
Representative Finke.
No.
Chair Novotny.
Representative, or Chair Mueller. Actually, I'll go back to Representative Finke. Representative Finke, your bill has on line 1.14 contains conspicuous markings. What is your definition of what a conspicuous marking is?
Representative Finke.
Something that's easy to see. Thank you. I mean, Madam Chair, yeah. Conspicuous meaning you can see it easily and it's obvious.
Chair Novotny.
So obvious. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Another question. Representative Finke, State Patrol, for example, has many unmarked squad cars. And I say that very carefully, unmarked as opposed to undercover. Your bill, under line 1.20, gives an exemption for undercover vehicles. And I do not believe, or I could be wrong, if someone wants to clarify that the unmarked vehicles are not covered by the unmarked. I look at all the transport vehicles that the Department of Corrections has. I look at multiple sheriff's agencies that I know of that have little or no markings because they want the anonymity when they're doing this. Your bill doesn't address just arrest for the first transport from an arrest scene to a holding facility. Your bill does transport of suspects. So going back to the point that Representative Witte was trying to make, this is any transport of person being detained or transported. So as an investigator, I had an unmarked squad, and if I was to pick up and transport a juvenile from one situation to a foster home or anything like that, that would have been covered. I wouldn't have been able to do that. You have a lot of questions and concerns about seatbelts, and you said you talked to law enforcement agencies, and I'm surprised that none of them pointed out Minnesota Statute 169686, which is the Minnesota seatbelt statutes. I've been a little distracted. I've been reading it over and over and over again. I do not see an exception in 169686 that says a law enforcement officer can violate this law as the driver of the vehicle. Do you have any information that you can point to me that says that everything that you're saying isn't already covered in Minnesota state statute?
And I'll just note too that the seatbelt language was taken out with the DE. So I'm confused.
Well, we're still transporting vehicles. I'm sorry, Chair Mueller, but we're still transporting people in vehicles that are unmarked. How are we going to address that? And if we need a fiscal note, if we're going to have to mark up all the state squads and the Department of Correction squads?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Novotny, I appreciate your question. The bill's intention is not to get rid of unmarked vehicles being used by law enforcement. We all understand the need for that. We all understand how those are used in investigation. The point of the bill is to transport people safely. And I do believe that we can do that. I do believe that we do not need unmarked vehicles for that. I do believe that we can detain and transfer people in a way that respects, it does not matter who that person is, whether or not they are suspected of what crime. And I'm interested in the question, specifically the question of the difference between undercover, the difference between unmarked, and what is used for what purpose and in the experiences. And I wish that we could have like addressed this bill like a bill, like we could have had some amendments come, because this is like hard, good work here that should, I think, become the law. The thing that's happening here is that we're trying to protect people who deserve to be transported safely. And I think that there are now, with Chair Novotny's comment and Representative Witte's comments, we could have really made a great bill here. that protected people, and I think that we all agreed on. And so I think I wish I had requested a fiscal note before the committee, and I apologize for that. But I think that your concern is legitimate, and I hopefully we'll be able to take that forward and we bring this bill back. This bill is clearly not going to move based on members' comments. So I will look forward to bringing these comments back next year when we hopefully can pass this bill and make sure that people are moved in cars that are meant for moving people.
Anything further?
Sure. Thank you. And I think you need to understand that we agree that people should be transported in vehicles that are meant to transport people. And it should be done safely. I think that, there's a lot of questions that we have, and I understand your motive for the thing. I'd also like to point out, Representative Curran, at no point did anyone on our side of the aisle say that we want someone transported in a van and unsafely. We never said that. I don't believe anyone said that, and, I could be wrong. But with that, I recommend a no vote.
Vice Chair Witte.
I just want to say one thing since my name was brought up. Part of it is, like at Burnsville PD, it's been about 10 years. We used to have an unmarked minivan where we had to belt people in, or you have to have the car seats to bring them out when you do it. We really do try to take the precautions to make sure that the kids have the car seats and the people are buckled in, because obviously transporting them from our jail down there, we do it in an unmarked vehicle, so our CSOs aren't always sticking out, and it makes it go a lot smoother. I think that was part of the discussion. That's why I was wondering about asking the BCA, State Patrol, and all the different agencies. The one part that really kind of threw me in this whole part is the seatbelt part being taken out, because if we're really talking about safety here, that should be the number one thing that stays in the bill. And I get it, there's other vehicles, but then that maybe is not the proper vehicle to be transporting people in. So I would love to have more conversations about it. It didn't make sense as I was reading through it and other people are reaching out. So thank you.
And Representative Finke, before you respond or give your final comments, I'm wondering if you'd like to for me to change the motion to lay this over in light of some of the discussion that's happened here and potential amendments to your bill. If you want to go ahead and take the vote and go to the general, try to get to the general register, we can certainly do that, but I'm wondering if you would prefer the motion to be changed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to lay it over.
Okay, so, and we'll do that in a minute, but if you want to give your closing remarks, please.
Yes, thank you. Just quickly to Representative Witte, I appreciate that. It's, I sent this bill to DPS and to the patrol, and they said we have to take the seatbelt language out. That's why it's not here. So now if we have to put it back in, we can, right? I mean, it makes sense to me to say, let's have seatbelts, but people use buses, and buses don't have seatbelts. I appreciate the conversation, as always, members. I'm here under good faith trying to pass good law to protect people. It's the only thing that matters to me in this job, is how we protect people. So I look forward to working on this bill, whether it's this year or next, and making sure that we are taking care of all of the people of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke, and thank you for bringing this bill. And I will change my motion to lay over House File 3358 as amended. The next bill on the calendar for the day is House File 1775. It is a Chair Pinto bill. And Representative Pinto, do you like to re-refer House File 1775 to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And I see that you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to discuss the amendment first or discuss it after adoption?
Madam Chair, maybe I'll just briefly describe it and hope that the members would be okay adopting it. And it's this is a bill that was heard by the committee last year, and some questions were raised And so we laid it over at the time. We've had continued work on it. One thing, trying to get the cost down. And so the DE2 reflects that work and those attempts to reduce those costs. And I'd hope the members would support the DE2.
All right. Any discussion to the DE2 amendment? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 amendment is adopted. All right. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Novotny and members. I hope that you'll recall House File 1775. This is a bill that is aimed at providing greater transparency to our pretrial justice system. This is something that I think is of interest to all of us. I will note the letters of support include groups from organizations from a wide variety of perspectives, kind of across the political spectrum, which I'm really proud of. And you'll see a fiscal note in the packet. That was last year's bill, and there is a fiscal note in process on this year's bill. If the committee approves advancing the bill to judiciary, I know that that will be with an understanding of the fiscal note back and have to have further conversation. We want to keep it moving in the meantime. I think I'd like to turn to my testifier to provide more discussion on the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Novotny, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Hall. I'm a criminal defense attorney at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis. And I led the Minnesota Justice Research Center's pretrial best practices project, which did some research that helped lead to this bill. In 2023, the legislature asked the MNJRC to study Minnesota's pretrial system and make recommendations for how to improve that system. Our preliminary report, which was submitted to this committee over two years ago now, recommends that the legislature create a statewide pretrial data system. So House File 1775 is a significant step toward making that recommendation a reality. Members, we know what the problems are with Minnesota's pretrial system. They're well documented, including in MNJRC's 2025 report, also submitted to this committee. But without comprehensive pretrial data, we can't fully understand the scope of the problem. For example, all else being equal, people detained pretrial are more likely to plead guilty than those who are not detained pretrial. But how much more likely and how many people that impacts in Minnesota, we don't know the answer to. Another example, we know that people living in greater Minnesota are more likely to be jailed pretrial and for longer periods of time than their counterparts in the metro area. Why is that? How does that disproportionate jailing affect their case outcomes? How does it affect their communities? Minnesotans deserve answers to those questions, and we don't currently have them. Finally, members, the pretrial data system is essential for measuring the impact of any changes made to the pretrial system here in Minnesota. States like New Jersey and Virginia have already seen the benefits of this kind of comprehensive data infrastructure. House File 1775 would enhance the transparency of Minnesota's criminal legal system and increase public confidence in the fairness and equity of the system. I urge you to adopt House File 1775. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I don't believe we had any other members of the public sign up to testify, so we will move on to member discussion. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I think overall we want a public crime database to ensure transparency and accountability. But it seems as if this bill has been amended to remove that public access. Can you talk to me a little bit about why that's been the decision?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Engen. I will say a lot of the goal was to cut costs at this point to at least get the process going. I mean, I think you could tell by my testifier, and there's an interest across the political spectrum to have as much transparency information as possible. The first thing we need to get going is to get the information to get collected and get gathered. The information, there will be accessibility. Maybe Ms. Hall can help remind me about where they'll be afterwards, but we had heard last year that that was a concern regarding cost. We're now not even in a budget session, makes it even more challenging. So candidly, we wanted to get going on this and get the data gathered and to kind of go from there. But my testifier may have more to say on this.
Ms. Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Engen. Just for some context about this bill, currently the data that's relevant to the pretrial system lives in a bunch of different places. It lives with the courts, it lives with the jails and the DOC, it lives with probation and supervision. It's not those data systems don't talk to one another, so they aren't even gathered in a place where somebody could start the analysis right now. And so I think what Representative Pinto is speaking to is just that starting the process of getting them into one location is step one to then making analysis available to the public. I think, you know, in terms of the major changes made this year, they really were because of cost. And so rather than requiring the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to do the analysis, to publish the analysis, which would require full-time employees, it simply gathers the data and then makes it available to research institutions to take on that cost.
Representative Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be super quick. I appreciate the response. What qualifies as a research institution? That's not defined. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it's not defined. I would think it'd be understood pretty broadly, but it may be that that our nonpartisan staff may have thoughts about how broadly that would apply. An institution that does research, I guess I would assume, which could imply quite a few, but.
Don't know who wants to. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, when a term is not defined, if it was challenged, the court would be asked to give it its commonly understood definition, its commonly understood meaning. So a research institution would be, as Representative Pinto suggested, likely interpreted as any sort of institution that is engaged in research.
And Madam Chair, maybe one final thing, if I may.
Representative Pinto.
Yeah, I'll just say, Representative Engen, the goal is definitely not to hide the ball here. So if, this will have at least a couple more committee stops. And so if folks have thoughts about a term that would be broad enough to encompass organizations that people in either party are interested in, we're not trying to hide the ball on this at all. So,
Representative Egan?
I'd love to talk offline. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I remember having conversations about this for a while. How long have you been working on this?
Representative Pinto.
Madam Chair, several years ago, came up with the idea that we needed to look at our pretrial system. I think we had a bunch of ideas, and that turned into that report Ms. Hall referenced, which then turned into we can't even do much until we have data for all of us. So several years.
Representative
Hudson. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question that I have, kind of along the same lines as where Representative Ingram was going, in terms of, because you talked about the cost and trying to get the costs down, and I do remember that being part of prior conversations, that was a difficulty. How does making the information available to research institutions as opposed to anybody who publicly requests it, what impact does that have on cost? I'm not following.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think part of it, the original version of the bill you'll see required a report to be prepared and a lot of analysis being done by the government agency itself. And our thought was, let's at least get the data in place, and instead of having government folks do an analysis and reports and things, we've at least got the data, and then organizations that are interested can then look at that data and draw their own conclusions. And that does save money. I think that's the main thing, unless Ms. Hall has anything else she can think of. But I think that was the big thing.
Ms. Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hudson. I think the main other consideration I would note is the court's restrictions on its own data. They are very, very careful about what data becomes public and what does not. For example, data regarding cases that do not result in conviction is not public data under the judiciary's rules. And so in terms of simply collecting all the data and then making it widely publicly available, that's not currently permissible under the judiciary's data rules.
And Madam Chair, one final thing.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Representative Hudson, we will see how successful we were at cutting the cost because we don't have the fiscal note yet. So I guess we'll compare the original fiscal note with the one we're going to get, and I hope we're successful, but we will find out.
Representative Hudson.
Yeah, real quickly, Madam Chair, thank you. I think... I get what you're trying to do here. I agree with it. I think the term research institutions and perhaps just some clarity once we get to judiciary about how it interacts with Chapter 13 and all of that is just going to add some certainty to how this is ultimately implemented. So thank you.
Fair enough.
Any further comments or questions? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Pinto, I would offer this if you're worried about stops. House File 7 is sitting in Ways and Means. If you'd like to work with me on a DE for that with the numbers that you have. This is something, as you know, Representative Pinto, because you've been around since I first got here, something I've pushed for since at least 2021. this kind of information. I'm glad that, you know, we can move some form of this forward. Eventually, I would like to get to, I would hope that my successors find some way to get this as a publicly searchable option. I agree that getting this is a step, and I'll take that first step. And for that, I recommend a yes vote.
Right, and before your closing remarks, too, I just want to thank you for working on this issue for so long. The stakeholders who I know have worked really hard in trying to bring down cost, which were the concern with last year's bill. And just as we, I think we noted this last year and you in your opening comments as well, just the wide range of stakeholders in this packet, people who normally don't agree with each other on a lot. It really is remarkable, and hearing that both sides of the aisle really do want to come up with a solution, I think is really encouraging here. So thank you again for bringing this bill, and to everybody who's been working on it. And with that, closing remarks.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I should have highlighted Chair Novotny's leadership in this area. And I mean, that bill and Chair Novotny, I've got no pride of ownership, and all. I think that Chairs Liebling and Scott are going to want to hear this. So probably the easiest thing is at least send this bill there, and then happy to talk with Chair Moeller and you and leadership about kind of what makes the most sense to get this done. So no issue there. But yes, thank you all. I really hope that we can finally get this going. I think we all have an interest in gathering this data, and we may have some different thoughts about where it's going to lead and where the policy solutions are, but let's at least start gathering it. So thank you, chairs and members.
Great. Representative Pinto renews the motion to re-refer House File 1775 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. And members, that concludes today's agenda, and this meeting is adjourned.